Well, ladies and gentlemen, disappointing to start the 32nd Eric Abbott's Memorial Lecture in this way, but who can prevent traffic becoming a problem? I think driving in, there became a huge ambush, as it were, of some sort, I don't know what, and so a tube was transferred to, and then there was a problem with the tube, and it took 20 minutes to get everyone off the tube, and then I think a taxi has been taken, and there is every possibility that Sally will, having picked up a taxi about 3 or 4 minutes ago at the Albert Memorial, anyone's guess is as good as mine, but I would have thought she might be here by about 5:02. Now, I'm not going to take another poll. What I think I'm going to do is to introduce the lecture, and then Richard Burridge probably will begin reading. And she's perfectly content, I gather, to take over when she arrives. When she does arrive, I hope we shall stand as one and applaud. But let's see what our reaction is by that point. It may be quite different. Anyway. First of all, may I say welcome on behalf of the Dean and Chapter. It's a great pleasure to see you here. And this is the 32nd Eric Symes Abbott Memorial Lecture. Now, someone who decided she couldn't stay but thought she might go to Keble tomorrow evening to hear it said to me, so who is Eric Symes? So I pointed out to her that it was Eric Symes Abbott, who was Dean of Westminster from 1959 until 1975, before which he was warden of Keble College, Oxford, for about 5 years. Before that, he was dean of King's College, London, so Richard Burridge, his successor. And before that, he was warden of Lincoln Theological College and other ministries before that. So he had a most distinguished career in the training of clergy and in academic life before becoming, for 16 years, Dean here. I've often found myself speculating as Dean which of my predecessors as abbots from 960 or deans in each particular century I regard as the greatest Dean of the century. Now, there's no great difficulty for the 19th century. It's Arthur Penrhyn Stanley, who was Dean from 1864 to 1881. Not quite so easy in the 18th century, because after all, life was a bit different in the 18th century. But I would nominate Joseph Wilcox, who built the West Towers, consecrated in 1745, in the 18th century. In the 17th century, I suppose I would have to say you couldn't possibly doubt Lancelot Andrews, who was dean from 1605, from 1601, in fact, to 1605, who later became Bishop of Chichester, then Bishop of Ely. This joke might not run for very much longer. And then Bishop of Winchester. And we could go back. I think in the 16th century, there's no question at all in my mind that Gabriel Goodman, who was dean from 1561 to 1601, must be one of the great deans. Well, there weren't that many deans in the 16th century because, of course, they were abbots. So which would be the greatest abbot? Certainly, in my view, John Islip, who was abbot from 1500 to 1532, who finished building the nave, who built the Lady Chapel, built a wing on the Abbey. And I could go back through the 14th, well, if you'd like, 15th century. How long should we have? I think John Eastney for the 15th century. 10 minutes away. I think we could identify someone from the 14th century. No, 13th century. I've forgotten who I had in mind. Richard de Ware, who built this church in the 13th century, and we could go back beyond him. It's Nicholas Littlington, probably, for the 14th century. There we are. So who from the 20th century? Well, it's difficult to say, but Eric Abbott certainly was one of the great deans of the 20th century. There were others, Herbert Ryle, who brought in the grave of the unknown warrior, Alan Donne, dean at the time of the coronation of the Queen. But Eric Abbott's time here, he presided over the marriage of Princess Margaret and Princess Alexandra. But probably more especially, in 1965, he celebrated the 900th anniversary of the consecration of Edward the Confessor's church And they spent a whole year celebrating one people. And that's been a very important ministry in the life of the Abbey. He opened up the Abbey through the 60s and early 70s in a remarkable way, while maintaining an extraordinary ministry to clergy. So after his death, a group of people gathered together, including John Robson, who's still a trustee, it's very close to him personally, and this series of lectures was begun. This evening's lecture is on faith and imagination, how the arts speak to the reality of the unseen. And Sally Vickers, psychoanalyst, literary critic, best-selling author, since she's not quite here yet, I'll confess that I read Miss Garnett's Angel yesterday and enjoyed it absolutely enormously, and look forward to reading some of her other books. And does that mean she's 5 minutes away now? Probably. I think we will ask Richard Burridge to begin reading her lecture, which we have. And it may be that at the end we won't have questions quite in the way we had thought. But please, when she comes, give her the warmest of possible welcomes, and very warm welcome to you.
A tour de force from the Dean of Westminster, worthy of Eric Abbott, I am sure. It's been a delight working with Sally on this text and getting it prepared for publication. And as always, it will be available at the back of the Abbey tonight. It's the first time I've actually had to make sure we've got Greek font in a lecture. So I feel I've got to know this lecture quite well. So I, it's a great privilege to be asked by her to at least start it, not least because Sally has revived a tradition of the Eric Abbott lectures, which is by beginning with a personal story and reminiscence of the great Dean himself. Faith and imagination. How the arts speak to the reality of the unseen. May I begin by telling you a story about Eric Abbott, whose memory we are here today to honour and celebrate. Before I threw caution to the winds and embarked on the perilous career of a novelist, I worked for many years as a psychoanalyst and psychotherapist. In that time, I had in my care a woman who has since died. I shall keep her anonymous, but I do not think she would mind my recounting this story, as it was one she often liked to tell herself. She was a very gifted schoolteacher, but she was emotionally fragile, susceptible to that syndrome psychotherapists increasingly recognize, a savage and impossibly taxing perfectionism. During her periods of fragility, my client was beset by a fear that she was too lacking in faith in the value of life to be acceptable to God. During one of my annual breaks over the summer, she experienced such a depression, and with me away, called upon the help of Eric Abbott. I'm not sure how she had first come to his notice, but she had often quoted his sermons to me in our sessions together, and on some earlier occasion, she had corresponded with him. On this occasion, with me out of the country, she wrote to him explaining that she was at a crisis point and felt that she could not go on feeling as she did, incapable of faith in a wicked world. Never having spoken to my client, Eric telephoned her and spent half an hour counseling her, ensuring, I am convinced, her renewed hold on life. When I called to thank him, he said, "It's what I'm here for, to be a spokesman for God for those who are in pain or distress." I met Eric several times after that and felt that few people could have been better chosen to speak in human terms on God's behalf. One of the subjects we discussed was the problem of encouraging faith in an increasingly secular society. Since Eric's death, I fear society has moved further, on the one hand, on a tide of secularism, and on the other, a surge of faith that has taken an increasingly dangerous and disturbing path. One of the matters that I remember Eric being taken by was my suggestion that loss of faith was possibly linked to a decline in the appreciation of the arts. So, as one who nowadays tries to contribute to the arts and has a concern for the well-being of the arts in our society, it was this subject I felt, in honor of Eric, I would like to talk about today. Faith, we are told in the letter to the Hebrews, is, in the King James translation, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. The author of Hebrews then goes on to give a tremendous list of all the many occasions when Old Testament figures have let faith be their protection and guide. "What more shall I say?" he continues in his vociferous way, having apparently already run the gamut of all the Old Testament heroes, of Gideon and Barak, of Samson and of Jephthah, of David and of Samuel and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. We can at least be thankful in these otherwise benighted times that there is not the same call on us to stop the mouths of lions. There is more to follow in this vigorous catalogue, and this is not just because of the author's seemingly inexhaustible energy, but because what he is proposing is that almost anything which is not subject to tangible proof requires us to have faith, since faith is the necessary prerequisite to belief in anything not seen. We live in a world where there is a high, and some would say exclusive, premium placed upon empirical evidence or scientific testing. And yet, as Tennyson says, "Nothing worth proving can be proven, nor yet disproven." As very little which gives value and meaning to life can be tested or seen. Yet today we have research programs to test the efficacy of prayer, experiments conducted into whether those who die can survive death, and an area of the brain has been identified which can be demonstrably shown to be activated when we are in love. But none of those empirical tests get to the bottom of the prayer, or the way those who have died continue to haunt us, or the continuing mystery of the affections of the human heart. The best such experiments can do is to register that there is a physical correlative, a counterpart to what I like to call intangible realities. The poet William Blake, as so often, puts his uncanny finger on the limitations of a purely materialist description. "The atoms of Democritus and Newton's particles of light are sands upon the Red Sea shores where Israel's tents do shine so bright." Democritus was a pre-Socratic philosopher, and in the 6th century BCE, I'm not sure if Blake would have known this, science, which of course merely means knowledge, was a common subject of poetry, and philosopher-scientists habitually wrote their thoughts in a poetic form. In fact, even Newton in the comparatively modern 17th century believed in alchemy and astrology and had a fascination for the irrational. But what Blake's epigrammatic lines indicate is that we now live in a world which assumes a separation between the material and the immaterial realms. As well as part of the brain which is activated when we are in love, there's a part popularly known among scientists as the God circuit, which, if stimulated, gives rise to perceptions of the infinite or the ineffable, even in those who are convinced atheists. This area of the hippocampus is of comparatively modern evolution. As with the grammar centre, it is a mere upstart system, having only evolved within the last 100,000 years. But this centre, which is more active in certain people, epileptics, as well as religious visionaries, appears to be a corollary of certain religious experience, does not of itself account for or explain or define religious experience, or prove that it is simply a function of a particular set of nerve cells and neural pathways. All it shows is that religious experience has a physical resonance and dimension. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Sally Vickers?
To hear my own words.
They're rather beautiful, actually. I'm enjoying this.
You'd like to go on?
Have a glass of water.
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
Tell me where I'm up to.
We're just on the God circuit.
Okay. Right, we've got different pagination.
Yes, let me find it for you.
Talk about faith. Talk about imagination. God circuit? Have we been on the Jacob's Ladder? How about the imagination? As well as part of the brain. Yeah, okay, we haven't got to Francis Thompson.
Yes, we're just here. In fact, yes, precisely there.
Right. Thank you, John, and Richard, for a fabulous warm-up act. I've been swearing like a trooper, most unsuitable for the present surroundings, but now I will continue and compose myself. So all that shows, all that's been said before, is that religious experience has a physical resonance and dimension. And this may also suggest that at a certain point in our human development, it had an evolutionary purpose, that receptivity to religious belief may have had a role in human survival. And that's not just my fanciful thought, that is a quite legitimate current evolutionary speculation. In a sense, though, religious experience is itself evidence of things not seen, since it is an identifiable measurer of what in its very essence is invisible. Some would prefer to say non-existent. But if these experiences reflect non-existent matter, one can only say they have always been non-existent in a deeply and profoundly influential way. The poet Francis Thompson left when he died an unpublished poem, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Let me remind you of it. O world invisible, we view thee. O world intangible, we touch thee. O world unknowable, we know thee. Inapprehensible, we clutch thee. The poem employs paradox to define the phenomenon which the love experiment on the brain reveals. The human capacity to be affected at the sensory level by what is seemingly invisible, intangible, and inapprehensible. Being a poet, Thompson goes on through the use of language to bring all of that, the invisible, the ineffable, to birth in our imagination and consciousness. Does the fish soar to find the ocean, the eagle plunge to find the air, that we ask of the stars in motion if they have rumour of thee there? The angels keep their ancient places, turn but a stone and start a wing. Tis ye, tis your estranged faces that miss the many splendid thing. But when so sad thou canst no sadder cry, and upon thy so sore loss shall shine the traffic on Jacob's ladder, pitched between heaven and Charing Cross. Yea, in the night, my soul, my daughter, cry, clinging heaven by the hems, and lo, Christ walking on the water, not of Gennesareth, but Thames. The poem is about faith, in this case the capacity to perceive and thus to see in the everyday what cannot be perceived by everyday vision, to see the marvellous and the remarkable within the ordinary, and more importantly, to interiorise it. But it could just as well be a poem about the imagination. The capacity to transpose the image of the vision of Jacob's ladder from its original site in ancient Israel, in a story of the Old Testament, to a 20th century London railway station, or Christ walking towards his disciples across the Sea of Galilee to a progress across our cold Thames, is not merely a matter of faith or belief. It requires also an act of creation. Nobody, not even the devout and mystical Francis Thompson, believes that there were winged beings mounting and dismounting a ladder constructed somewhere in the sky above a central London terminus. The Israelites may have believed this marvel actually occurred in their forefather Jacob's history, but they lived in a culture where the visible and the invisible were more of a philosophical continuum. What Francis Thompson does is to create, through the medium of a poetic language, a place within us, within our imagination, where the image of that heavenly ascent and descent has a reality of a different kind to that which we use to negotiate a railway journey via Charing Cross. But, and an important but, is still nonetheless a coherent and describable reality. Anyone reading or hearing that poem will have some sort of image in their mind of angels, ladders, railway stations, water, and mixed in with all of these another element, an emotional element, which, to use the poet's own image, clings to the hem of the poem. Something to do with passion, which is also something to do with suffering, and also to do with suffering's impassioned answer. In other words, through the process of the poem, Francis Thompson gives form and substance to things not seen. Shakespeare was very interested in this realizing or making real faculty of the imagination. In A Midsummer Night's Dream, he has Duke Theseus compare the lunatic, the lover, and the poet, who, he tells us, are of imagination all compact. And as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. In this speech, it is the creative power of the imagination rather than faith which is being emphasized. But Shakespeare's phrase, the form of things unknown, has a clear echo of the letter to the Hebrews, evidence of things not seen. And evidence is a word which derives from videre, the Latin word to see, which is why, I suspect, the translators of the King James version of the Bible used evidence rather than the modern version's convictions, because it makes a kind of meaningful play on things seen and not seen. Bear in mind that when Shakespeare has Theseus use the word nothing, whatever opinion he may have given Duke Theseus the character, he, the author of Duke Theseus, intends no disparagement. Few words were as potent and significant to Shakespeare as nothing. Nothing will come of nothing, King Lear warns his daughter Cordelia, but the whole body of that awesome play is born out of those awfully ironic lines. Everything, but everything, comes from that nothing in King Lear, rather as everything comes out of the void in the story of creation in Genesis. And Genesis, in Greek, of course, means birth. Let me put it like this. Faith is the hope of the truth of the unseen, and imagination is the faculty which gives form to or brings to birth the unseen, so that its reality becomes manifest and in a special sense visible to us. The Francis Thompson poems talks of angels, and angels are a good example of the way a meeting of faith and imagination gives rise to this special kind of supersubstantial reality. And angels also happen to be a subject which has quickened my own imagination. Because I am known for having written a book about an angel, and because otherworldly beings drift in and out of my books, people sometimes ask if I believe in angels and spirits and ghosts and so forth. And the question is interesting to me because behind it is an implicit either-or. Is what I write about something I believe in as an actuality, or am I merely having a bit of fanciful play, as if these are the only alternatives? In my novel Miss Garnett's Angel, I retell a very old story alongside the contemporary story, my own story, of the heroine Julia Garnett. The story is that of Tobit, one of the Naphtali tribe, which along with 9 other of the 12 tribes of Israel was carried off in 722 BC in one of the first recorded holocausts by the conquering Assyrians to disappear for all time. Old Tobit, exiled in Nineveh, according to the story, which has been passed down to us via the Hebrew scriptures, continued to exercise his Jewish piety by burying the dead, an activity outlawed in the story by his Assyrian captors, although in reality the Assyrians buried the dead just the same as the Jews. However, as the story goes, as an indirect result of his subversive burial activities, Tobit is rendered blind and incapacitated, and as a consequence sends his only son Tobias on a journey to the far-off land of Medea in order to collect a family debt. The concept of debt is itself interesting when we consider that the Greek, in the Matthew version of the Lord's Prayer, actually asks not that our trespasses be forgiven, but that our debts be cancelled. In the original Greek, which of course was a transliteration of the Aramaic, it reads, "And cancel us the debts of us, as also we have cancelled the debtors of us," which I hold, though I'm on dodgy ground here because I'm not a Greek scholar, can also be rendered, "Cancel our debts insofar as we have cancelled the debts owing to us." When Jesus speaks of debts, he clearly isn't talking the language of a Barclays bank manager or a mortgage broker or an EU commissioner. He is talking the language of a culture where the actual still stood in for the metaphorical. So what he is describing are those myriad incalculable things we tend to feel we are owed, forgetting very often all the equally many things, or more, which we ourselves owe. What the Great Prayer really says, I want to suggest, is that once we overlook what we are owed, what we owe is also lifted from us, not as a quid pro quo, but through or by virtue of our own impulse of and capacity for forgiveness. In the creative act of cancelling a debt owed, we have our own debts cancelled. Let's hope the EU consider that suggestion from me. In a still earlier period of history, the 8th century BCE, when the story of Tobit was evolving and probably first being recounted orally, the actual lived on an even firmer footing alongside the metaphorical. Indeed, in those days, the two were generally one. There was no need for metaphor to transfer anything to a higher or more abstract level, because that wasn't how the 2nd or 3rd or 8th century BCE mind worked. Before Tobias sets off for Medea, his father, fussing about his son's safety, as conscientious fathers will, urges him to hire a serving man from the marketplace to accompany him on the hard and dangerous journey he's about to undertake. And it's more than a step and a hop to Medea from Nineveh, so you can imagine the sort of fellow Tobit has in mind, physically strong, capable, courageous, level-headed, steadfast, loyal. In fact, exactly the qualities that Tobias needs to accomplish his mission successfully, the qualities that are going to make him into a mature man. And Tobias finds just the right person, going by the name of Azarias, and he and his people are even known to Tobias's father from the old days back in the temple in Jerusalem when things were done as they should be done. Except he's not Azarias at all, we are told, in our privileged position as audience, but the archangel Raphael, one of the 7 great archangels who go in and out before the face of the Holy One. Or is he? Is this so-called archangel in disguise perhaps just the bundle of qualities which young Tobias needs and will acquire as he makes a testing journey into maturity? Is the story not saying, in an imaginative fashion, that the passage to manhood is a perilous one, and that to make it successfully, some more than ordinary help may be needed, and, if we look for it, is on hand? The idea that this, at one level, is an initiation story is borne out by the fact that once the journey is embarked on, the issue of the family debt is quickly sidelined. Away from the father, Azarias introduces a whole new factor into their quest, a potential marriage between Tobias and a young kinswoman called Sarah, who, rather like the debt, has apparently been forgotten until now, but is conjured into sudden significance by the angel. Or you could say that once the young man gets away from the rather stifling home atmosphere and begins to assert his own authority and independence, his mind turns naturally away from financial matters to sex and marriage, and the family obligation falls naturally to the back of his mind. The girl Sarah turns out to be cursed. A savage demon, Asmodeus, is lodged inside her body and has murdered 7 men who have tried and failed to penetrate her virginity. But, with the help of Azarias, alias Raphael, Tobias is able to find the necessary spirit to banish the demon and penetrate and finally marry the girl, and even collect the family debt and finally cure his father's blindness. And only after all of this does Raphael reveal himself as an angel. In my 20th century version of this story, I recast the demon as a form of sexual neurosis, and the story of Toby and Sarah, the 20th century cousins, as the overcoming of evil and guilt by the power of love. I dress the drama in contemporary clothes: sex, guilt, child abuse, mismanaged psychotherapy. But these are just other ways of defining what is differently described in the old story. And who shall say which is better, or more true, or real? Who or what is Raphael really? In my novel, he's the only character who appears in both the stories, but he appears too in other guises, not only as Azarias, the hired hand in the Tobit story, but also in the forms of various characters who act in helpful ways in the contemporary story of Julia Garnett. Because what I'm trying to show, taking my cue from the wise old story, is that angels are not so much others' beings, but states of otherness, or states of being other, however you like to put it. They are whatever helps us to rise above what we are or have been, which in most people's lives is usually accomplished through the agency of other people. So it's not a question of whether or not I believe in angels, but that angels provide a time-honored form for dramatizing what today we have only rather nebulous and dreary and abstract concepts for. You might say I'm playing with these old ideas, but the play is a serious one. As Shakespeare knew, and Hamlet tragically forgets, the play's the thing. The play is real. Now let me now turn to an example of faith given by the author of Letter to the Hebrews, in which so-called angels also feature. They appear in the form of three anonymous guests who pitch up unannounced at the dwelling of the patriarch Abraham and his wife Sarah. Through faith also, the author of Letter to the Hebrews tells us, through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed and was delivered of a child when she was past age. You may have seen these angelic visitors depicted on Byzantine paintings, sitting rather stiffly, their wings not altogether accommodated by the seating arrangements, along one side of a table, while Abraham and Sarah wait on them. They are the first of a number of divine visitations, which lead finally to the naming of Jacob and the establishing of the King of Israel. It's interesting that there are three of these strangers, because while they are three, they are also one. In the biblical context, it is hard not to think of the Christian Trinity. But I suspect the Christian Trinity takes that form because, as the ancients knew, the number three is a numinous one, being both creative and inclusive. In another ancient culture, the Pythia, the priestess at Delphi, who uttered the prophetic sayings of the god Apollo, delivers the divine oracular pronouncements from a tripod. Three forms part of most psychological theories: id, ego, superego, shadow, ego, self. But three is also a fundamental number for life: man, woman, child. No matter how genetic science evolves or human beings elect their gender, for life to continue, there will always be needed a sperm, which is male, to enter an ovum, which is female, to produce a new human life. The author of the book of Genesis tells us that these three strange beings are aspects of the Lord, and it seems also pretty clear that the very late conception of the child Isaac, who will be born to Abraham and Sarah, is an oblique consequence or corollary of their act of unpremeditated hospitality. Sarah is, or has been, barren. In economic terms, this is a problem for the wife of a future patriarch. But let's forget the outer situation for a moment and concentrate on the inner. The Jewish god Yahweh is often depicted as being either rather up on his high horse or being something of a wet blanket. But here we have a charming example of the way he rewards the elderly Sarah by making her laugh. Sarah laughed within herself, saying, "After I am waxed old, shall I have pleasure in my Lord, being old also?" The ambiguity of Lord in the King James Version, seeming to imply it might be either her husband or God she is referring to, is suggestive. In entertaining the strangers, Sarah gives access to something larger. And her husband, whose ministrations have so far left her barren, is now imbued with the numinous procreative abilities of her God. It's a lovely moment of spontaneity, a kind of jubilant precursor and antithesis of the Last Supper, and in many ways as significant in its outcome. Entertain means accept, take in willingly, hold, or keep among. The three vital presences, angels or aspects of the Lord, are accepted graciously, nurtured, given bread and wine, the basic foodstuffs of life, which in the Christian story will become the symbols of communion with the divine. Furthermore, these visitors are given these goods in ignorance of who or what they are, under the law not of exchange, but the other law, which is also as old as civilization, the law of hospitality, which gives without thought for the cost or for any return. As with the Tobit story, it isn't necessary to see these mysterious guests as winged beings from another realm, although in this form they make gravely beautiful subjects for paintings. In the ancient Greek Bible, the so-called Septuagint, which is our oldest extant translation of the Old Testament scriptures, they are not described as angelos, which anyway only means messenger, but anashim or andres, which, as many of you know, means men. They are men, we understand, but at the same time they are aspects or reflections, call it what you will, of divinity, not so much because of what they are in themselves, but because of what they constellate in Abraham and Sarah, a generosity of spirit which is prepared to share whatever is available even under conditions of dearth. The inner dearth of the couple, their inability to conceive a child, is, through this uncalculated action, made fertile. And it is through this act of unpremeditated generosity that the strangers, the men, become more than men and angels. The miracle works both ways. Both stories, the story of Abraham and Sarah and the Tobit story, take a common human difficulty and give it not only a wider poetic appeal, but also offer a dramatic account of how the difficulty may be surmounted through trust, courage, self-forgetfulness, qualities, virtues, I would rather say, which, while entirely human, are not easily commanded without the aid of some other higher state of consciousness, and which, in turn, prove generative. You get exactly the same kind of dramatization of what we might today perceive as entirely internal and invisible processes in other great stories of the ancient world. In Homer, for example, the goddess Athene doesn't appear to Telemachus, Odysseus's son, as a goddess. She appears as a family friend. Athene flashed down from the heights of Olympus, and on reaching Ithaca, she took her stand on the threshold of the court in front of Odysseus's house. And to look like a visitor, she assumed the appearance of a family friend, the Taphian chieftain Mentes. But her presence in Ithaca is not simply a clever piece of storytelling art. She is there for an important psychological purpose, to reassure and encourage Telemachus that his father is alive and needs him. "The reason for my presence here," says Athene, "is this. I actually heard that he was home, I mean your father. The gods must be hindering his return, because the good Odysseus is not dead. He must be on some distant island out at sea. I am no seer or soothsayer, but I will venture a prophecy to you, which the immortal gods put into my mind. Your father will not be exiled for much longer from the land he loved so well. He will think of a way to return. He is endlessly resourceful." This comes at the very beginning of the Odyssey, and it is this visit from Athene in the likeness of an old friend of his father's which galvanizes Telemachus to make inquiries after his father and to begin to deal effectively at last with the suitors who are plaguing him and his mother in Odysseus's absence. But what's really going on here? Or how might we describe this scene today? I think we might say something like this, that a family friend came to pay a visit, and through reminiscence and affectionate recall of Telemachus's father, activates something of the same paternal resourcefulness in his son. The human effect is the same, but the means used to describe it is very different. And some of us, frankly, prefer Homer's description. Because Homer's account adds, if implicitly, this other dimension. The goddess is the vessel of valor, and at the same time, her own numinosity is generated by the valor of the young man. The human being, some would say soul or psyche in Homer's version, becomes the crucible for both the reception and the recreation of the divine. Gods and goddesses, angels and spirits, ghosts and demons are imaginative representations of the unseen realities which affect and have always affected human decisions at the deepest levels. A great tradition of art gives them the form of independent external presences. But this is only a way of assuring us of their objective, if hidden, reality. And by extension, the objective reality of the invisible world. But notice how I say only. The hint of apology defines the modern problem. For to conceive these forms and also to recognize them for what they are requires both imagination and faith. If we poo-poo Homer's gods and goddesses as old-fashioned phantasms of a less sophisticated, more infantile era, we miss the depth and power of that culture's understanding of human consciousness, which is no less modern and psychological for being described in these seemingly unpsychological terms, as if psyche, which is the Greek for soul, were a modern discovery anyway. There's a great moment towards the end of Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale when Hermione, the wronged queen of Leontes, who through the destructive consequences of his overweening jealousy has been believed dead for 16 years, to all intents and purposes, returns to life. She has been both dead and not dead in a way that perhaps only Shakespeare's genius could pull off. Dead to the king, her husband, and to her daughter Perdita, but also alive, both to them and to us, as an image of vital life and unsentimental goodness, which cannot be defiled. A story, another one, has been put about that a statue of Hermione has been fashioned by a consummate artist so like the real woman that it may be mistaken for Hermione herself. And the conceit is that, of course, this is no statue at all, and it is in reality the woman who has both lived and not lived in this lapse of time. At the moment of revelation, Paulina, the architect of this creative deception, says to the assembled company, "It is required you do awake your faith." Only then does the living woman step, as it were, out of the stone. It's a truly amazing moment, because Shakespeare really makes us feel that there has been not just a resurrection and Hermione has been restored, but that art itself has crossed some mysterious threshold and comes to life in our presence, become life itself, but a life now made incalculably more precious by being imbued with a proper awe, which the apparent loss of it has guaranteed. And it is art, both the art of the sculptor, who doesn't exist, and Shakespeare's own art, which has created both the non-existent artist and his work of art. The statue, which exists in this mysterious place of otherness, and which both is and is not a work of art. The statue which has preserved this life within the large, elastic, numinous sanctuary of the play. Remember, too, that this is being played by a woman actor in Shakespeare's day. A male actor playing at being a woman, who is playing at being a queen, who in turn is playing at being a statue made out of stone. Think of all the complicated business which underlies this scene, and then hear that singular, compelling moment when Paulina declaims, "It is required you do awake your faith." At that moment, all those other complicated elements drop away and become beside the point, and we are left with another miracle, the miracle that those few simple-sounding words can bring a dead woman back to life, not just for her husband and daughter and the court of Bohemia, but also for all of us, for all time, or as long, anyway, as Shakespeare is read and heard and enters our being. And yet, as Leontes says, in words of heartbreaking simplicity, if this is art, then 'tis an art lawful as eating. So what is this art lawful as eating, which, like the food we digest, becomes, if we absorb it, inextricably part of us. In the days when I taught literature, I used sometimes to play a game and ask students whether or not they considered Hamlet, the prince, not the play, real. Now, obviously, there's a sense in which he is not. He doesn't pay taxes or parking fines, but then neither do many real people who are living today. You might protest that, nor, for example, does John Stuart Mill. I just plucked him out of the air as being rather different, who is not living, but once lived, and has died and been given a memorial service. But then I would say so is Hamlet, rather a splendid one with pallbearers and sounding trumpets. And yet clearly Hamlet has not died in the way John Stuart Mill has, and you and I surely will. But neither is he alive in the way that you and I or Stuart Mill once was. But I think you may agree with me that there is a sense in which Hamlet's reality is as assured, possibly more so, than yours or mine. What I'm driving at through the case of Hamlet, or Hermione, or Odysseus, is that reality is not defined by the act of having been a subject of everyday sentient life. No one can tell us exactly what Hamlet looks like, because no one has ever seen him. And yet, we all know something of what he is like, what his essence is. Hamlet, in fact, is not only real, he is immortal. Although he does famously die, in a crucial and important sense, he can never die. And yet, his creator was a mortal man. I think where imagination and faith meet is not only in the conception, the perception, and the bodying forth of things unseen, but in the power of those forms created through the medium of imagination to surpass death. The imagination, to quote from another of my novels, Mr. Golightly's Holiday, is a creator of worlds. From it has issued gods and kingdoms, people and purposes, stables and citadels, deserts and mountain tops, the defeat of principalities, the frail victory of hope. In that book, I try to suggest how the imagination is the creator, or rather, the creator's chief executive, and how the creative principle is perpetually at work in and through, for as well as being a reflective, it is also an active force in and through the imagination. That creation is not something which happened once upon a time, but is always happening, all the time, forever bringing new life to birth, out of seeming nothingness, making what was unconscious conscious, just as it was in the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. Or, in another later version of the story of creation, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Which, if you look at the original Greek, could, I want rather heretically to suggest, also be read as, in the beginning was the story, and the story was God, and God was the story. A reading which, to a novelist, makes sense. I suggested that when people asked if I believed in angels, they were asking an either-or question. Does she think angels are real or not? And I have asked my own question. Is Hamlet real or not? Behind both questions is a deeper one. What do we mean by real? And as a corollary, what do we mean by story? By story, you can assume I include myth, poem, play, anything which apparently arises out of a mortal imagination but has an independent existence. Paul and the disciples were asking people to believe a story, a hugely powerful one, that a man had died and come to life again simply because he loved enough. In fact, he and the way he lived came to define, at least for much of the Western world, what real love means. It's a terrific story. And although it is unique, it also shares much with other stories that have informed and nourished human society, since the beginning of civilized time. And real stories are not ours to make up. They are there to find, much as scientists in another realm find new particles or planets, if we are attentive enough and if we are lucky enough to have their reality made to us. When I taught a course on myth many years ago, I used to start by asking my students what a myth was. The class would come up with various definitions, and then I, rather smugly, would declare, "A myth is something which gives us the facts." Any real story is something that gives us the facts, but for it to be real, it must be more than a mere description of factual events, because that's merely an account of reality and not a recreation of the thing itself. But then, I am begging the question again, what is real? Fairy stories, myths, legends, the poems of Homer, the plays of Shakespeare survive because they are stories which not only engage us with their truths, but allow something real to happen inside us. And maybe this is the key to their value. I've said elsewhere that I think the defining quality of great art is not that we understand it, but that it understands us. But thinking about this talk, I felt I wanted to go further and suggest that a great work of the imagination expresses itself by working and reworking a creation within us so that we are taken up by it, and through it, we too become a contributing part of a creating process, and so evolve. A work of art makes us for a while become Hamlet, or Telemachus, or Hermione, or whoever it may be with whom the artist has aligned our sensibilities, so that with this other we weep and tremble and curse and suffer and rejoice. And as we are captured by that other reality, our own reality is enlarged in the mystery of the otherness of others. We might also, if we reflect on the experience, recognize that we have been deeply and powerfully and often irreversibly affected by something which at one level is no thing. A thing or things not seen. It takes enormous faith in things not seen to coax into life a story and to be in turn enlivened by it. I think in this way the creations of real art are true manifestations and evidence of things not seen, because they are also reflections of the biggest thing not seen, the process of unfolding, which is creation. Small stories which illuminate and dramatize that much larger story within which we all move and have our being. But I believe, too, that faith works both ways. It takes faith to make the unseen seen, but it also requires faith to see and believe in that unseen made seen. I'm very fond of the almost certainly apocryphal story of the man who, watching Othello for the first time, was unable to contain himself and shouted, "Can't you see he's fooling you, you stupid beggar?" I'm bowdlerizing his language in deference to the sacred place in which I stand. I am with that man whose imagination was awakened enough to see that the darkness of Iago is real, deadly real, even though Iago cannot be detained in any psychiatric prison. Iago doesn't disappear when the actor who plays him takes off his costume and goes home for a quiet pint. Iago exists, and he continues to exert his deadly influence. And Shakespeare is there to ensure that we see him and that his presence occupies and troubles our moral imagination, if only we have eyes and ears. The eyes and ears are internal ones, but as with our material bodies, they need proper nourishment. That is why it is vital that our children are helped to read, encouraged to go to plays, to listen to music, to enjoy and criticize paintings, because art is food for the spirit, And the consumption of art should not only be lawful as eating, but understood as vital to the healthy sustenance of our society. The arts are the vessels that promote and keep alive faith in a deeper, intangible reality, one that promotes a creative life that our age of galloping materialism is in grave and present danger of starving. Thank you.
The Dean of Westminster and I have decided, we will cut the questions, and I will try to keep my vote of thanks brief. But after such a wonderful feast, it would be wrong not to be able to say thanks, because this lecture has been about faith and imagination, and how the arts, and especially written stories, plays and novels, keep faith alive in an increasingly materialistic and spiritually impoverished age. Sally's lecture has been a wonderful blend of beautiful prose and insightful wisdom of the ancient and the modern, blending Homer and Shakespeare with the Bible, telling and retelling those stories that can evoke and bring faith in us today. Miss Garnet's Angel was one of the first Sally Vickers novels I read many, many years ago, and it was lovely to hear again its retelling of the story of Tobit and the angel, not to mention the dog and the fish. More recently, I've been reading another of her novels, The Instances of the Number Three, when several other themes of tonight have appeared, of Hamlet and the ghost, of Cordelia and King Lear, the significance of the three people who loved Peter, his wife, his mistress, and his androgynous young friend. Recalling us tonight, the three men, three angels, persons of the Trinity, id, superego, ego, whatever, who brought faith and life to birth in Abraham and Sarah under the oaks of Mamre. Sally has a great gift in connecting the ancient world, not just the Bible, but Homer and the Greeks with our own, and so often going via the genius of Shakespeare. And I appreciated how tonight's lecture began with a story, not one I was expecting to have to read myself, but a story of Eric Abbott himself, as so many of these lectures have done in the past, of how his love and concern for people brought life and faith into a situation of despair and darkness. So thank you particularly for that, Sally. It's been a delight to get to know and work with Sally a little over the years, not least through our involvement in Cumberland Lodge, where Eric Abbott himself would go and be known. I think of Amy Biller's vision of how to combat the darkness over Germany in the 1930s, and as we often perhaps ponder the forces of darkness in our own society today, so Sally has taken us back to story and the imagination. And in discussing that wonderful translation of the divine logos of St. John's prologue, in the beginning was the story, and the story was with God, and the story was God. At the end tonight, Sally, you've given us the story, as you have through all your wonderful books. And that story's brought us to God, to faith, to life and love, truth and beauty. Just as indeed did the ministry and teaching of Eric Abbott at King's and here in this abbey. And for that, we are very grateful. Before I ask you to thank Sally one more, this is, of course, an Anglican house of worship, and therefore there has to be notices. You will find on your seat advance notice of next year's Eric Abbott Memorial Lecture, when the Reverend Richard Coles, the cleric, broadcaster, former communard, a star of BBC and all of that, and a parish priest, will be speaking on the subject of the spirituality of a parish priest on Thursday the 24th of May next year. Copies of tonight's wonderful lecture are available for sale at the back, and some of the lectures and previously in this series, and you can find them all, of course, on both the website of the Abbey and of King's College London. Thank you very much for attending. Thank you for your patience. But above all, please help me to thank Sally Vickers for this wonderful lecture.